Because you're jumping back into the gap. All right, to coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game.
All right, we're here with Dave Smart, ready for part two of the podcast. If you didn't get a chance to check out part one, from last week, we discussed philosophy, particularly competitive philosophy. Today, we're going to dive into some of the technical, tactical, and some of the wonderful things that Dave has done to be so successful. And Dave, welcome back to the podcast. And let's start with this defense that so many people are intrigued by and want to understand better. And I think one of the first things that we got to start with is, what do you call it? Do we call it the force we can? Do we call it the force left? What is this defense?
Yeah, I mean, we don't really call it anything. We call it our quarter court defense. And I mean, our number on it is 20, but it just because of where we pick up. But basically, I think a lot of people talk about it like it's a weak hand defense or it's a force left defense. And I mean, that's really not the case at all in terms of the gist of the defense. I mean, yes, there are places on the floor where we want people to go where they're weakest in terms of their ability to pass, but we're not forcing anybody anywhere early. We may be pushing them certain directions and dictating a little bit, but we want, like anybody else, we don't want to have many help situations. We don't want to put ourselves in those situations. So we're not closing out, forcing any certain direction, certainly on short closeouts. I mean, long closeouts, then it becomes a bit more of what I guess people call a weak end defense, only because we want the other four guys on our team knowing exactly where the ball is going on a long closeout and when we're in recovery mode. I guess we do fluctuate a little bit when we're on one side of the floor, whether we're going to square the guy up or get up into him and push him to his weak end to the baseline so that there's the baseline, the help, the guy covering him and his weak hand all playing into the fact that he might not be able to play. But even then, that's based on a matchup. I mean, if the guy's really good, we're not letting him get in the paint easily in any situation from anywhere on the floor.
Well, and that comes back to a few things and a few thoughts. And that's number one, that you said it. The goal is no help. And that's the goal of any good defense, is to not help and to not have to rotate. And I think people, this is a misnomer when people say force weak hand. I mean, you're not trying to help at all. So you don't want them to be in rotations at all on the defense. And then the second part is obviously what you just said. This is more of a matchup defense in the sense that you're not matchup in terms of matchup zone, but you're focused on matchups and then what players individually do better. Can you talk about that a little bit too?
Yeah, everything we do is based on the individuals and the matchups, the individuals on the other team. And sometimes, as guys get more experience, it's not just what they can and can't do. It's also the matchup in play. I mean, ideally, you're not only looking at what the offense can and can't do, but it's what the defense can and can't do against that offense. I mean, very seldom, there's two extremes when we're going to force to a weakness. And again, even then, it is usually only on that one side of the floor where they're going to the baseline to their weakness. And that's if a guy is so good that we've just decided we're going to run two guys at him. So we're going to dictate where that's going to happen. And we're going to make sure he gets out of the floor, but or gets the ball out of his hands. But that guy has to be so good that we're willing to admit that we have nobody who can, with the help of four other guys showing bodies, keep him out of the paint. That happens very, very seldom. I mean, it does happen, but it happens very seldom. The other is, if we just think the guy stinks and he's a shooter, but he stinks, it's like we're not going to let him shoot. And we know if he puts the ball on the floor to a bad spot with help, he's going to turn it over. So those are the two extremes. Anybody anywhere in the middle, which is where most people fit, we're really trying to square them up and make a good move to get somewhere. And then we change what we do if they're going to their weakness, when they're making a strong move, or if they're going to their strength. And that starts happening around 10 feet. And we want them going, ending up, if they're going to be aggressive, going to their weakness 8 feet and in, where they don't have many choices. And they have to be a passer with their, well, going to their weakness when they're deep.
So much of this is on
you as a coach to identify individual player weaknesses. So I imagine when you're watching film, you're focused more on the individuals than on what the team is running.
Yeah, I mean, we joke about this, that we spend a decent amount of time talking about what the other team is running, mostly to make our players not think we're terrible coaches, because they think this is part of coaching, is you know exactly what the other team runs, and you show the team what they run, and you're always prepared, and we'll call when they call their stuff, we'll mimic it, and we'll yell what we think it is, but we don't care. We may get a bit of a heads up. Like, there might be three guys on my team who are smart enough. I shouldn't say smart enough. Experienced enough and smart enough to take advantage of knowing what the other team runs. But we're really all about covering their actions and the individuals in those actions. And a lot of our team stuff is just to make our guys feel like they know as much as the other team knows. But really, we could go. That's why I think we have so much success in August against the U.S. teams, is because we don't need to know what they're running that year. We just need to be able to go and see what each individual does and what he doesn't do. And we're prepared as we have to be, as prepared as we may be for a national championship, because we've seen them on tape their entire junior year, sophomore year, you know, and so, like, sometimes it's tough with the freshmen, but our defense is based on the individual players and what they like and don't like doing.
So when you do video and scout video with your players, is it mainly the personnel?
I would say it's probably 60-40, because we try to, because no matter how much we talk about it, our players still think it's important. Like, every other coach is spending so much time showing what the other team runs that they think that's what coaching is. So if you don't show it at all, they might lose faith. They still have to be confident in what we're doing. So I would say it's 60-40 if I trusted our guys. Truly believe that all we needed to know was the individuals and need to know what they ran, I'd go 80-20. I mean, I think that's what all we really need. Because really knowing what they run, all you're gaining out of that is knowing their actions, but we work on that all week anyway within our own stuff, and making them uncomfortable because they think when we call what they're running and we have a call for it, that we're one step ahead of them. But really, we're one step ahead of them only because we know exactly what each individual wants to do and doesn't want to do, more than they probably see it on a daily basis.
Well, I hope at some point you get the confidence to go 80-20, Dave, as a coach. If you don't have it now, I don't know when you'd ever have it. But okay, let's talk. So has Synergy and the analytics, has that helped this process? Because you have a better feel for points per possession going a certain direction, left or right or whatnot. Do you follow that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Synergy, I think it makes it easy for everybody. I think it makes it easy for the lazy people, and I think it makes it better for the people who work hard. But in order to make it better for the people who work harder than everybody else, you have to think outside the box. You have to do things outside the box. And I think we do this a little different than everybody. I think everybody cares about personnel. I just don't think they are as anal about it as we are and as focused on it every single day. I mean, our practices, part of what I like about what we do defensively is that it forces all our players to constantly play in their weakness, which allows them to get better. There is a negative to it. Like, again, I talked about Phil in our last talk, but Phil's coming back from Russia. And I said, so what do you think we need to work on this summer? Like, what's the big plan? And he said, I got to figure out how to go right better. And, you know, he doesn't go right that well because he's spent so much time and been forced to go to his weakness so much more. He said, I can't make the plays I need to make at 8 feet and in when I get taken to my right hand deep, because I've never get any reps. I haven't got any reps at that for 5-6 years.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because Doug Novak, the great coach at Bethel University, when I had a discussion about this, and I said, if I was ever brave as a coach, when I would play Carlton, I would force everyone right. Now, that would completely change our defense in some context, which is hard to do. But from a logistical standpoint, it makes sense that you force you guys, your players, to their strength, because they spend so much time on their weakness. Now, obviously, your players are good enough to handle that, but
That's basically what you're saying.
I mean, I think it would kill us for the first quarter. I think our guys would be so surprised by it and so uncomfortable with it. For the first quarter, they'd play tentative. They wouldn't do what they needed to. Now, second quarter and on, all of a sudden now they're playing to their strengths and they realize that this is ridiculous that we're nervous about it. But I really do think they'd be taken fully out of their comfort zone if that happened for probably 10 minutes, the first 10 minutes of the game.
Well, I don't want to jump to offense, but, and by the way, if we ever get to coach against each other again, I guess they gave away my game plan. But the other thought that I always put in my player's head, and probably our teams that have ever had a chance to compete against you guys have always been good at this, literally, and we don't want to jump to offense, but we are, to not help against your team and to make your players drive to score. Because another psychology of your players is that they're so good at finding the open player on penetrate and kick and finding the three-point line that in practice, I imagine that you guys are doing that almost every time. So a team that's trying to make you finish between you and the basket is not what they're used to.
Yeah, and I would agree. I mean, we spend in our individual workouts and our 1-on-0, 1-on-1, 2-on-2, all that stuff, we spend a ton of time, like not just like everybody else teaching the skill, but we spend a ton of time talking about the fact that because of the way we practice and the way we focus on making, not just making the other extra pass, but trying to constantly penetrate and kick and cause closeout situations, that the teams are going to just say, you know what, we're just going to cover you straight up 1-on-1. And we do that kind of once every 2 weeks where we aren't allowed to help and we just play it straight 1-on-1. And the problem for our practices when we do that is it seems like a great idea, but we're so focused on them winning every drill, they just always just give it to the best matchup and let them play 1-on-1. So it really doesn't help the other four guys. So yeah, I would agree. That is one of the things that we struggle with, is just scoring constantly at the rim. And that's why we spend so much time working individually on it.
Well, and it's something I stole from you, is the concept of like playing 4-on-4, no help, 3-on-3, no help, where there's certain times that you strengthen your individual, because again, we don't want to get beat. Strengthen your individual defensive presence or focus by playing no help. And we've gone into weeks where we play you guys if you're the first matchup, and we would literally say that we're going to say no help at all this week. And we would play that no help all week to get ready for you guys. So it's just interesting. And I assume that's what you're talking about, that you go 1-on-1 or you play your 1-on-1, but in your shells, you play no help still?
Straight no help. And again, it works until they figure out the hole in it, in that just find the best matchup and stand and watch. And then only one guy really gets to defend and only one guy really gets to play offense. So we got to break it down, obviously.
Well, and again, for what we tried to do, all of it is just psychology for my players to believe there is some type of edge, because there really isn't. But you're trying to convince them there's some type of edge here. And that's part of the coaching process. So back to the defense weakness. When you watch, let's simplify it for someone who says, hey, I love this idea, I love this defense. What are the weaknesses that you look for in a player? And keep it as simple. Can't dribble, can't shoot. What else?
Well, I mean, the first thing is, where do they struggle to pass from? If you can't pass at a high level, you can't play. I mean, it's similar in almost every team sport. If you can't pass, you can't play. And it doesn't matter how well you score. At some point, you're going to play against a team that's too good. If you can't pass, you can't play. And so our big thing is just trying to figure out where people are comfortable passing and where they're not comfortable passing, and make them always go to a place they're not comfortable passing. It's not about whether they can score or whether they can't score. It's about basically making them go where they need to get them going, so that they're always passing it from a place they're not comfortable from. Because on target, on time is the key to winning, and it's the key to losing if you can't do it. So making sure that people can't pass it on target, on time, is going to change the whole dynamic of the team. And again, I think people don't look at film and things like that close enough all the time, in terms of how many passes are on target, how many passes are on time, and how many combine that, and how can you stop people from doing that? I mean, it's like in the NBA, it's not a case of whether James Harden can make that play going to his right hand. It's how much of a difference is it in terms of on target, on time, when he's going left as opposed to going right. If it's a big difference, then you have an advantage over everybody who doesn't force him to make that pass going to his weakness.
Let's give an example of that. So there's two things that have come up when we played you. One is that a right-handed player that we've had, you would still force right. And I assume that was based on his ability to go left to be able to pass, which was not normal. But then the other thing is certain small players that I've had on my team, you force smalls baseline. Is that a part of what you're talking about in terms of where you're forcing
right.
in terms of their ability to pass, right?
Well, I mean, I think we have different calls on the ball. And back to the right-handed player forcing him right. I mean, sometimes a Kevin Durant's a perfect example, or a Steve Nash for different reasons. Steve, because, you know, his ability to pass going left is almost better than his ability to pass going right. And like most players, I think he's a better scorer going left than he is going right. So even though he's going to be a very effective passer going right or left, because he's so good passing going left, he's a better scorer going left. So force him right and try to make him more of a scorer going where he's not as comfortable, because he has to, because of his lack of size at that level. And, you know, I don't want to say lack of athleticism because his hand eye is off the charts, but run jump, he has to move his feet further to take pull ups. So it just changes what he can do going right. He's a guy I would force right. Kevin Durant, I'm not sure he passes it better left than right, but it's not a big difference because he's 7 feet tall. So he's going to pass it over top of anyone who's covering him, and he can pass it with his right hand anyway, even if you end up getting him going left. And he is so good scoring left, you need to get him out of his comfort zone and get him playing where he's not as comfortable. And the passing difference just is minuscule. So it gets back to where he can score from. But there's so few guys who can pass at the same level going right or left that it's all based on them going where they pass the ball weakest. And then the little guy thing, you know, like if you've got a little guy, why let him get in the paint in the middle where he has more opportunities? If you get little guys going baseline and there's bigs to help and you're bigger than the person covering the little guy's bigger, then all of a sudden, even though they're going right, their size becomes a huge detriment. So, you know, yes, we'll force little guys and we'll help later with little guys and let them get out of that comfortable passing pocket, which the smaller you get, the smaller that pocket is, you know. So we don't want them to be allowed to pass it between 17 and 10 feet because that's where they want to pass it from.
So if we're talking then, so one of the weaknesses you try and identify is passing. Is there a list after that, or is it mainly start and end with passing in terms of direction of force or where you're helping from or how you're helping?
Well, I mean, it's all dictated by the pass. Where the cutoff happens, that's dictated size-wise. I mean, so on the ball, we'll call different things. We'll never call ball. Maybe in transition, we'll scream, I'm picking up the ball. But in our transition D, we sort of have the dictated plan in that anyway. But on the ball, they're going to be calling square. And we all know what square means, whether it's ultimately left or right, depending on the individual. But we'll call square. We'll call early. We'll call dead. We'll call late. And it's all based on the individual. So, for example, square would be just a normal matchup, you know, where everybody off the ball's staying with our base, you know, and where they are is based on what that call is and how good their guy is. But it's pretty base oriented. Calling early would mean, you know, we would go early on Harden, especially if they didn't have all their shooters on the floor at the same time. I mean, that's why they have so many shooters, so you can't go early on them because you're giving up too much to go early on them. But
not to interrupt, but with early, so what you're saying for coaches, understand that, like a player off the ball is basically in the pack. You're not in denial, you're in the pack. But would you then force them towards the worst shooter?
As much as we can, yes.
Yeah.
You know, okay. So that's the job of the guy that we call a non. You know, I mean, it's 2019, so maybe I should be nicer and demurring, but I don't really, I mean, basically.
A non-shooter.
A non-shooter, or a guy that we want to handle the ball on because he's not a playmaker or he can't shoot. So, yeah, so that when we're early, it's up to the guy who's covering the non or the two guys who are covering the nons to make it very clear where they are and make sure that the ball is coming in their direction and that we're making their main guy give it up to the guy we want him to give it up to. So we don't just want him to give it up. We want him to give it up to a certain person or a certain two people, the nons.
And then dead is no help. What's late? Yeah.
So dead would be no help, meaning everybody try to deny, everybody try to keep the ball out of their guy's hands as much as they can. Obviously, in order to do that in the post, we still have to have post help on a lob or three-quarter front. But basically, we're trying to keep the ball in the hands of the guy who has it, and then that guy just plays him one-on-one and forces him to make plays. Because even if he does make a play, it's probably a low percentage play, but if he doesn't, then the mains will tend to not want to pass him the ball even more the next time. So it just adds to the defense. And then late, it's a case where if we get a switch and our big is covering a little, you know, we may go late there, but more often than not, it's a case where they have a little point guard who's tough and gets in the paint and makes the right choice. So we don't want to help too early. We want to help as late as possible so that he gets himself into a situation where he's just too deep and he has to pass it over top or around too much size. Every pass he makes is going to be, it's just going to not necessarily be off target because it may not be off target, but it's not going to be on time because of the arc or the direction he has to throw it.
Some people will be surprised by the term square. So let's talk about that a little bit. So your players are not calling left or right in terms of where they're forcing the player. They're saying square. So how do they know like that it's a weak hand force or a strong hand force or whatnot? Just everyone has to know that player?
Because we've gone through the scouts so many times. They know how where we're ultimately trying to make them go at 8 feet, you know, and if they aggressive attack. And, you know, we're bluffing on every dribble, so we want five guys covering it. But, I mean, the square, they need to know how we're playing every situation. Plus, that's on a short closeout situation or a situation where there's been no penetration. Once there's been penetration, now on the long closeout, we are screaming right or left. And that's partly to help our teammates, but more to make the offensive player feel like, even though they're in an advantage situation, that they feel like we're taking control of that advantage situation by dictating what they're going to do.
Let's go into the closeout then. So what are you teaching on closeouts?
Well, I mean, again, it depends if it's a long or short closeout.
Let's talk about basic biomechanics, like what's the technique of them running out and stopping? What are you teaching? Are they square on the closeout? Are they forcing a direction? Where are the hands? What are some different things in terms of that?
I mean, we're stick hand. I like the stick hand just because I think it allows them to be a little more athletic with their other hand as opposed to two hands where I feel like, and if somebody feels more comfortable two hands on the closeout, we let them. I am big in everything that we do that there's certain basic things they need to do. They need to, like, for example, in a closeout, they need to show hands high so that it discourages an early shot. You know, it gets them, makes them taller, doesn't make them a foot and a half shorter than they should be. And it just puts something in the offensive player's mind. But I'm not big on saying it has to be a certain way because I think people have to be athletic in what they do. So they got to find their own way. So we talk about, you know, this has to happen. But beyond that, as long as this is happening, whatever you feel athletically comfortable doing, do it. Same thing with, you know, this has to happen in terms of getting a proper angle, especially in a long closeout, and the stutter into it to make sure you get to your balance as quick as you possibly can and get to your rocker step situation so that you can rocker step and give yourself the best chance to cut off that first move. But there's no, to me, perfect way to do it because everybody biomechanically is different. So everybody is going to be a little different in terms of what's athletically comfortable for them. So there's no absolute detail to it. And I think when you're two laissez-faire about it, they're going to be sloppy and they're not going to be good at it. When you're too technical about it, they're going to be robotic about it and they're not going to do it quick or athletic. And if they don't do it athletic, they can't be quick in it. So we have certain rules in terms of the angle, in terms of the sprint to stutter to close out. You know, we have certain rules in terms of certain hand position, but we do not make them do it a certain way every single time.
Oh, this is a great answer in that part about laissez-faire about it. That's definitely the key. But again, not being overly technical, because I see some coaches just like teach their players 100 things on a closeout and then watch players never actually do any of those things. So definitely don't overcomplicate it.
And again, like there's got to be certain things that they, in my mind, that they have to do. Like it's the same thing with your shot. I mean, everybody shoots different. It's like a golf swing. Everybody, all the best players swing a golf club different. But there's certain base mechanics that every single high-level golfer has, high-level shooter has. So, you know, you would need to have those things or you're not going to be successful. But everybody does it different beyond that. And then the other thing is in how you teach it. I mean, I think you see in our practices, for the coaches who've seen the practices, that we compete in almost everything. But when we do our individual stuff, we do break stuff down where it's fully not competition and it's done at slow speed, where we show the exact way they need to do things, where it's clearly development. In my mind, it's got to be development or competitive, and you can develop within the competitive, but you can't try to do the pretend combination. Like, for example, in close or a defensive shuffle, I will show them sort of slide, shuffle, slide, and I'll get our coaches and say, look, show the technique that we want them to be close to, athletic in, but close to, and do it at 1/10 the speed. Show it to them. And then let's put them out and get them to do it as fast as they possibly can. Let's film it when they're doing it as fast as they possibly can. And let them do some things that they do naturally and athletically that are a little outside what the 1/10 the speed would show. But when they're struggling with it and they're not gaining speed and getting better at it, or they're not going fast enough, show them from the breakdown what they're not doing in the full speed, but make them compete and make them figure it out on their own. And I'm doing that with hockey, with my 9-year-old and 6-year-old. I'm trying to work with the coaches because I'm not like hockey. I played, but it's not my expertise in terms of technical, although I'm trying to get better at it. But like what I'm working with the coaches on is stop trying to combine the competitive with the development, separate it, and then let them go. Let them make some mistakes. And when they're struggling, then take them aside and show them what they're struggling with. But let them fail with the competitive side first.
That's great stuff. And for coaches, we discussed a little bit of the slow learning and concepts like that in the first podcast as well. So awesome way to bring it together. So coaches looking at this, thinking about this, one of the first questions I'm sure you get, and I've got a lot, is this defense age appropriate? Like, can you run this with an under 11? Can you run this with an under 12 team? And I think I know the answer, but what are some of the things that you would do differently or modify at the youth level?
Well, I mean, I think definitely, I mean, we just came from Toronto at the sort of the national or provincial championship level with the 9-year. That's, the kids had great success because of it. And I do think that people underestimate how smart these kids are and how easy they find learning. You know, I think we try to dumb it down for young kids when it's almost in many ways easier for them than it is a 14, 15-year-old kid who's been playing for 6 years and never really thought the game. You know, like these kids, if you teach them to think the game, and, you know, I was saying to someone today that, like, they asked where I got it. And I said, well, to be honest, mostly from a million pickup games, like where people who just, you know, if there's 40 people at a pickup game and if you lose, you have to wait till six teams play until you get to play again. All of a sudden, you're not covering that guy who can't shoot. You're not covering the best player with one guy. You're covering him with two or three people. You're not letting shooters shoot. You're not letting penetrators who can't shoot penetrate. Like you get in a pickup setting where you got to wait 2 hours before you get to play again. And I mean, that's less and less nowadays because kids get coached too much, but you get in that setting and all of a sudden everybody's coaching and everybody's thinking and everybody's making sure that no one gets to go to their strengths. And that's where it came from. And then just modifying it and changing it and putting it into a team concept. It's really just common sense. So I think with the young kids, they have common sense. You know, they know who can't shoot. They know who can really penetrate. They know who's quick. They know who's slow. They naturally, like if you just let them naturally trap the people they want to trap, they trap the right people, you know, like, and a lot of times, a lot of them as a group will trap the right people for the right reasons. Like they'll trap the lousy player and try to get steals. And they'll trap the really good player and protect the basket. Like it's amazing if you watch them try to think and say, like, think about the matchups and think about who you're playing against. Let me see your scrimmage and let me see how you handle this defensively. It is amazing what they can figure out on their own.
Yeah, it's great. And I love that part of it, which is definitely, I could not agree more. And I suspected your answer. And that's that we totally underestimate kids, what they can do, and put them in situations where obviously they can learn and they'll learn, especially if you hold them accountable in the right ways. So it's great. And from that, you can talk about that. You can talk about the next level. But like, how early are you introducing this? Is this day one? So a new player in your program or you take over a new youth team? From day one, you're talking about the individual matchups on defense, or is it a gradual introduction of the topic?
I think we introduce it right away, and then we move slowly through the stages in terms of where they're comfortable. And those stages, again, like everything else, it's just see how it goes. Sometimes they move fast, sometimes they move slow. But, I mean, when it moves fast, you can't turn around and go, oh my God, I'm a brilliant coach. This is how fast it can always move because I'm brilliant. No, it has everything to do with the kids you're working with. And when it goes slow, you can't go, well, no, like I'm a terrible coach, or no, we have to move at this speed. No, this is the group. So move at the speed you got to move and keep the standards high, but be realistic about what you're seeing. So, you know, we'll do it at almost every level. I mean, certainly at the grade four level, we'll do it. Certainly when guys come into our program, they are thrown right into the mix and then we help them through it. I mean, it's the whole thing, I guess. I mean, I don't like talking about it that way, but that's really what it is. Let's see what's out there and make you realize that you have no idea how to play this game yet. And then take you aside and say, okay, it's really not that hard to get there as long as you'll do it in the right progression. You know, and then, so the grade fours are doing it. I mean, I think Rob, my nephew, he's doing it with, I mean, my grade one, they're doing it. I mean, I say to my grade one every day that, you know, until you get really, really good with your weak hand, it's going to be hard to score in practice because your team won't let you go to your strong hand. And, you know, he's in grade one.
That's great. Coaches have a pretty good feel for, I would say, baseline drive more than middle drive. So in those situations where players are attacking to the middle, what are some of the things in terms of help rotations that you want to have happen?
Well, I mean, we turn it into more of a run and jump when it goes middle. We really try to dictate with how far we're off the ball and bodies shown in the paint. I mean, I'm trying to put in terms where no matter what your terminology is, it's easy to understand. But basically, when their weakness is to the middle, we want to discourage that attack a little bit more than we would when it's going baseline. And it's easier because you can show more bodies because they can see more bodies since you're in the middle of the floor. But we also turn it into a run and jump, and we make sure that our guys are very clear that if they're helping, they have to help, like not to overhelp too early. That's where we get in trouble sometimes, is we help too early when the ball's going middle, when we don't really have to, you know, when the defender has them under control. And we want to help the defender get them under control way earlier when it's going middle than when it's going baseline. But the run and jump is key because we keep it a three-man rotation and really turn it into a run and jump. And depending who's attacking is how we play with that third guy who's going to the first pass. If it's a weak guy, then we're shooting the gap and we're trying to get steals. I mean, we're way more aggressive than people think in terms of what we do defensively, in terms of trying to get steals off the ball. But we're trying to get steals from guys who are turnover prone. You know, and sometimes the best scorers are turnover prone. But guys who are not going to make the tough pass, we'll respect that, and we'll just get there on the get to the first pass and let the guy who needed help run and jump to the next pass. So, I mean, we don't want the ball going middle. We don't want the ball getting the paint, period. But we especially don't want the ball getting to the paint when it would be in the middle of the floor.
And so how are you defining for your players whether help needs to come or not?
Well, at the angle that the attack comes on. I mean, we base it on the angle that the attack needs to come on and basically the communication of the guy on the ball. I mean, he's calling good if he's good, and he's screaming good when he's good. And it's no different than when we cover a ball screen. We need to communicate clearly what we're doing, no matter what basically coverage we've decided to play on the individuals we're playing against. But it's very important on that penetration for the guy on the ball to be communicating and the guy off the ball to be listening to that communication.
What are they calling if they're not good?
They're silent. They're covering the ball.
Yeah.
And then the guy who feels that he may need help, he's reading the angle. And if he needs help, he's screaming help. You know, that's our call. We never call help. It's the guy who calls help. And he helps when he feels he has to commit so much to the ball that he can no longer cover his guy. So he needs help on his guy.
This is great. And let's go to a screening situation. So let's start with off the ball screening. How does this defensive philosophy influence how you defend off the ball screens?
I mean, it really doesn't as much as you would think. Like, I mean, I've worked with people who want us to play. We do play down screens and flare screens and back screens based on making sure that we're always closing out, forcing to the weak hand. We don't actually do it that way. We base it on their personnel like everything else. So, you know, we'll, like on pin down screens, we're gapping nons, we're chasing shooters. It doesn't matter what side of the floor is. We're acting like we're gapping so we can chase. We're acting like we're chasing so we can gap. You know, we're always trying to get the screener to what we call get off the rails. So in other words, wherever they set up to screen, we want them moving their screen opposite of where we actually want to go. So if we want to chase it, we want to either lock and chase, which is get your head in the small of the back. If we can't bully the screen, get on the same path as the guy using the screen, like everybody else. But if we feel like they're a really good screening team and really good at setting up screens, we will start with lock and chase, recognizing that these guys are good at getting a gap. So then we act like we're gapping to chase, or act like we're chasing to gap. So the screener thinks he's one step ahead of us because he sees us looking to gap, but that's what we want him to do to give us a better angle to do what we want to do.
Dave Smart is one of the best coaches in the world, and now you can learn from him with never before available access. 3 all-access practices and 1 defensive coaching clinic are available at davesmartbasketball.com. What makes these all-access practice and clinic videos so unique? Dave Smart has won 12 national championships and has a winning percentage of 92%. Dave Smart's Force Weak Hand defensive system is world-renowned and has never been shared in this way before. Dave Smart has a winning record in over 50 games versus NCAA Division I teams, having beaten Wichita State, Baylor, Wisconsin, and many others. Dave Smart is recognized by Jay Wright, Mick Cronin, Jay Triano, and many other top coaches in the world as one of the best minds in basketball. Learn from one of the greatest minds in the game who opened his doors and shared the game with us from one of the most successful basketball programs in the world. Go to davesmartbasketball.com now to learn more and to purchase all 4 videos.
And how about ball screens?
Now, ball screens, I mean, there's just, the game is so much centered around ball screens now. We play it so many different ways, and we play it so many different ways based on personnel. I mean, we obviously try to bully every screen, and that's where the communication comes into play, where we don't have to show it all, and we just bully it, and the guy coming off the screen doesn't get to the screen, so there's no screening. So we break that down, and that's something that we talk about all the time, is don't make a non-screen situation a screen situation. You know, don't, if this guy isn't strong enough or isn't disciplined enough or isn't skilled enough to ever get to the screen or reject the screen, there is no screen. We're just covering this guy. Like, do not turn it into a advantage to them when we don't need it to be an advantage. And that's something we've gotten better at. I think 15 years ago, we didn't give our guys enough credit, and we really, you know, showed on screens where that we didn't have to show on. We went under screens that we didn't have to go under on, you know, and other teams took advantage of it with that in terms of causing some closeouts and causing some situations that we didn't, you know, the guy never got to the screen. We never had to do anything. We didn't have to help. We didn't have to triangle in the back row. We didn't have to do anything. So we really spend a lot of time breaking that down and doing it in a two-on-two setting and trying not to ever put ourselves in any coverage as much as possible, you know. But now when the teams we're playing are really good and we have to get into coverage, we have our base, but we change our coverage constantly. We will blitz sometimes. We will show and go under two sometimes. We will go over and what we call wait or wall sometimes. We will down. We usually don't down both sides of the floor like some people, because we just don't want people getting comfortable with their strong hand, with their strong passing hand. And we tend to rip people apart who down both sides. You know, if they down one side and do something other than the other side, sometimes we have some trouble with it because we have to make plays where we're not comfortable. But we do so many different things, and we never, I mean, if we stay with the same coverage on the same guy for the entire game, it's because we're winning by 50 and it's worked every possession. I mean, if we're in a game, we will change four or five times. Now, we will do probably two or three things, but we will change four or five times so that no one gets comfortable in our coverage.
What actions have you struggled with the most, if any? Is there a particular actions or particular concepts that impact you guys the most?
You know, I really think sort of what we call a W action, but kind of America's play, not so much the actual action that you think about. It's more so the little big cross screen followed by the pin down from the other big. We don't like to switch unless off the ball, unless we really have to switch off the ball. We want to keep our matchups as much as possible. We'll switch on ball screens a lot, and we really drill it and talk about how we want to play it and how we want to double if they try to go through the post and how we want to cover on the ball when they try to take advantage of the guard. But we really try not to switch very much off the ball. And because of that, sometimes with that second pin down screen, I find we do a really good job on the cross screen. I find we do a really good job of not giving up an open look on the pin down or the cleanup screen. But what we struggle with is our need to push the ball back where it came from for a one count. Like, I'm big on always getting the ball on any kind of flare action or pin down action to get the ball coming back where it came from, so that the jump to the ball bluff, the guy who's off the ball bluff, in order for them to turn the corner, they're just running in so much traffic. We really run into that catch, rip, and go opposite. For some reason, we struggle with it. And we drill it a ton to make sure it never happens. But that force the flare, push them back where it came from after the flare, we really struggle with that. And we've gotten better because we drill it so much, but it's the one thing I don't like what we do in our defense.
Well, it's great. I'd just be curious, and coaches should think about this, and I'd be curious how many coaches I would ask, and they wouldn't have necessarily a really defined answer for that. And obviously you do, and obviously you've thought about that because that's something that you need to work on to improve. So post-defense. So we're talking about individual matchups in the post. What's the focus in terms of that? Because I know you double the post sometimes. Obviously, you try and force it certain directions, but what's the overall philosophy in the post?
Well, so basically, and I'm an idiot, so my right and left block might be different than everybody else's right and left block. So I look at it from the defensive end, whereas I think everybody looks at it from the offensive end. But let's just say you're standing on the baseline and you're facing the far basket, the
yeah, actually, I got you. Let's, fine. You're talking left shoulder versus right shoulder turn to the middle.
Right.
But you would talk about it in terms of
people. So my right block is left shoulder turn to the middle.
Yeah.
My left block would be left shoulder turn to the baseline.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha.
So on the right block, we don't want the ball getting to the right block. I mean, just because it's so much easier for post to go uphill handoff from there, to pass it over their left shoulder from there, to dribble with their right hand to get to the middle of the floor from there. And it's so much harder to double forcing them to pass over their right shoulder because it becomes more of a spin. And if the guy's big, he can bully the wrong matchup on that spin. So we really work hard to keep it out of that post. Not to mention that if we are going to force anywhere, it would be on that right wing to the baseline with a right-handed player. So the post needs to be in a position where they can't get sealed off on that help. So it really works well with our defense. So we don't want the ball to get there. Now, if it does get there, that side of the floor, we do not want to double. We will if the guy's really good, but we do not want to double. So we will dig hard and really dig, and keep the offensive player out of the middle of the floor with the dig help, and then make the offensive player try to score over his right shoulder without any kind of double. And again, most guys fit into that block. It's a dig down, forced to score over the right shoulder, no double, and usually a front. Now, if the guy sucks, we won't front. We'll just let him catch it there, push him off the block, let him catch it there, go dead, dig a little bit, but basically dare him to score one-on-one if he stinks. If he's really, really good, then same as the other, keep it out of the post. When he gets it, dig like crazy, keep him off balance. But now when he puts a foot in the key, we jump him, force him baseline, and trap from the baseline and try to get the ball out of his hands and don't let him score from there. And again, it's all based on personnel. Our calls down there are really simple. If we're doubling, we yell dead. If we're going dead, we yell double.
Really simple.
Yeah. I mean, it's really simple for us. For the other team, not so much.
Right.
Now, as the season goes on, we will, every time out, we'll change that call. So, like, we see Ottawa U a ton. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't even mind saying it. Like, we will call double when we're going dead. We will call dead when we're going double. Then out of the next time out, we'll say, you know what, let's change it up. If we're actually double, we'll call double. Because they think they know our calls, we'll double now. Now, again, that happens late in the season. We never play them till after January. So by that time, we can actually change our calls mid-game, and most of our guys are pretty good at it because we do it constantly in practice.
Wow. Yeah, no, it's great stuff if you can get to that point. And are you doing that on other things or mainly just on post, or what are you doing them? Are you doing them on other places?
We're doing it with a lot of things, but mostly in the post. And you got to understand, we're doing it every day in practice. So the team, they can make whatever call they want. So I don't know if they're doubling or going dead until I see what happens. So in practice, their team could be calling dead and be going dead, or they could be calling dead and going double. So they get used to changing the calls within a 2-hour practice.
Well, it kind of vindicates philosophy that I share with my guys going into the week playing you, where I tell my guys, ignore absolutely everything they say. Whatever they say, ignore it, because it's just talk really to psych you out more than it is anything. Now, I know it means something to your guys, but to us, it means nothing. So don't even care that they're talking all the time.
Well, yeah, that's what I say to my guys. I go, like, this is the same thing. You guys get, like, you get all frazzled when teams come out and are screaming and yelling, and it doesn't mean anything. And sometimes it doesn't even mean anything to them. I mean, the well-coached teams, it does. But it certainly doesn't mean anything to us. So don't get caught up in it. Just play the way you're going to play. And, you know, I mean, your advice to them is perfect because, like I said, in practice, I don't know. Like, I'll say to the guys, you're playing offense as if you know the double's coming. And he goes, well, he's calling dead. Yeah, but he might be dead. And he goes, oh, yeah. They might have just changed the call on you in practice. And I go, I can't help you because I don't know what they're calling because I let them call whatever they want until they get, they're starting to lose. And then I go, how about you change because you're getting your head handed to you. But basically, I'll let them do whatever they want. So, again, it's what you're telling your guys is perfect because, I mean, what does it really mean to them? Because, like, it wouldn't mean anything to you, and I'm telling you what we're calling because every time out, it might be different by January.
Yeah, the opponent isn't smart enough, and that's why I don't get hung up on any type of opponent calls. Like, right. Just generally, I mean, we don't know what they really mean, and then more importantly, it doesn't really matter. What are we doing is what's important. So,
right.
Shifting to offense. Look, we'll really just focus on transition and spacing and shot selection. Because I think, again, you can run anything. And with your group, you could run anything. But I say the number one thing anyone asks me about playing against Carlton on offense and us defending is that we got to get back in transition. Like, we've got to be really good in transition. And I think that's something that gets lost sometimes. I mean, they talk about your ball screen. They talk about your penetrating kick. But you guys are by far the best transition team that I've ever coached against. So what are some of the things that you're emphasizing in transition?
Well, I mean, competition, first of all. So we actually, as much as we, like, we dictate what's going to happen in certain places on the floor with certain people on the floor. So basically we have guys who are matchups and guys who are passers and guys who are shooters and guys who are basically playing a role. And I don't care who's where. Like, there is no bias for me. It's like you earn it and you get it. And if you don't get it done while you're in that position, get him out of that position and someone else get in that position. So in practice, they dictate who's in those positions. And it moves around based on how well they're doing and how poorly they're doing. But I mean, we also dictate lanes, and whereas other people don't, and I get it, but I'm not big on excuses. And I'm not big on, well, I was over here, so I filled that lane. And I don't like the coach's excuses. It's like, well, why would you have that guy always running that lane? What if he's over here on a box out? And I go, why would he ever be over there on a box out? Well, what if the shot came from there? I go, well, he's supposed to hit and go. Like, he's always coming from the within 8 feet of the basket. Like, if he's not coming from 8 feet of the basket, he's not defensive rebounding, which is what we put the most amount of pride on, is our rebounding. So they're all coming from their same area. And if they're not, then you don't rebound properly. And like coaches will say, well, but there's situations. I go, there's not a situation. There's no situation where you shouldn't be getting rebounded. Like, in our world, I know situations happen, but they shouldn't ever happen. I mean, if you have a team for 8 months, it shouldn't ever happen. Eight or five guys should be rebounding. They should be gang rebounding. So it should be easy to get into whatever lane you need to get into from that spot. So we dictate lanes. We dictate matchups, and we put our matchups on the side of the floor that make most sense to whether we're going to play through the post or whether we're going to play through the wing attack. We also play through the matchups when the ball's in the middle of the floor, like our post matchup and our wing matchup. It's a subtle thing, but he's always posting up in a way that, in order to help, you have to help off our best wing matchup. So if you're going to help off that wing matchup, one pass causes a closeout, and then it's just attack and space, attack and space, attack and space. And we drill that 25 minutes of practice. I mean, probably more. I mean, it's the amount of time we spend on drilling our spacing is almost comical. Like, at the amount of shots and amount of time spent with our spacing and our post spacing, our guard spacing, our dive spacing, where they're supposed to go, just the subtleties of it. I mean, for us, it's all about transition and spacing and rebound.
So you also run two players to the dunker spot, short corner, whatever you want to call it, which is, again, not normal. You'll often run transition into a 3-2 set with two players down, but you can talk about that, but then also maybe talk about if there is a trail big, what they do in terms of that. Are they still running through to the 3-2? If they're ahead, they run to the dunker, and if they're behind, does someone drag ball screening, or what's happening?
Depends if he can shoot. I mean, we dive the worst shooter. So it doesn't matter, unless he's the point guard and he's little, we dive the worst shooter. So if, as our second diver, we dive our post matchup, he's in the dunker spot on penetration, and then we dive whoever shoots at the worst. And the reason we go two as opposed to one is I get it. Everybody says, well, it clogs up the paint. Well, for us, if you space properly, it doesn't clog up the paint. Plus, we're really diving. So that guy, it's a tough cover and like you can't do both. So you're either going to help and you're going to give up a layup, or you're going to cover and you're not going to help. And what it really does is it never has a situation where one guy defensively can X out and have his two on the offside kickout. He basically has to allow that offside kickout to be wide open. And we shoot an incredibly high percentage over the last 20 years from the three. And I do think we have good shooters and we take it very seriously, but we get wide open threes and we get it because we're always diving guys. And if you don't go with them, you're going to give layups up, you know, and as you spoke earlier, the best bet is to not help, you know, because if you're going to help, you really have to give up a wide open three. Cause once you help, if you stay on the three, you're going to give up layups.
Well, it's true. And for those that don't really appreciate it, understand it, it's really hard to cover you guys. And again,
you got to choose what you're taking away, and easier said than done. So transition 3-2 set. And then let's talk about the spacing, because again, it is so impressive to watch your players that they seem to always know where someone's going to be. Blind kick, you're encouraging them to leave their feet, all these different things that, you know, coaches traditionally would think were bad, but your players always know where their teammate's going to be.
Because we dictate it based on who the matchups are and who the matchups are. And I don't like to be an idiot about it, but I'll be honest, there's a lot of bad coaches out there who say, well, you dictate like certain guys can do certain things so they don't develop. And it's like, no. Once they walk on the floor, yes, everybody knows who our shooters are, who our penetrators are, who our post matchups are. If they don't like it, fix it. Train. I'll get in the gym every single, like, hours and hours to make you pass that guy who's ahead of you. So, I mean, we're not saying this guy is that position and he's in that position all the time. We are moving it around all the time. So, again, they fight to get in those spots. So they're always developing. I mean, a story I had with one of my guys a long time ago, and I mean, is Stu Turnbull and Osvaldo Gianni. And one of our practices, Osvaldo, who was our All-Canadian, and he was a fifth-year guy when Stu, I think, was second or third year. And in one of the practices, he took two or three pull-ups at a time, like late in the shot clock, but he took them at a time and he made one out of the three, I guess. I mean, Stu remembered. And Stu came down and took the exact same shot. And I said something to him, probably something very nice, but I said something to him. And I didn't say anything to Oz. And Stu came into my office and he sat down and he goes, what the hell? Like, this is bullshit. I took the exact same shot Oz took and he missed two out of three and you said nothing to him and I missed one and you lose your mind on me. He goes, this is bullshit. It's not fair. I go, Oz is way better than you. Am I missing something here? I want Oz taking that shot. I don't want you taking that shot right now. And he goes, well, what do you mean? How am I going to develop if I'm not allowed to take that shot? I go, I don't think you heard what I said. I don't want you taking that shot right now. I would love for you to want to take that shot in a month. And if you want to get up at 6 a.m. and every day, I'll come in with you and we will work on that shot till the point where I'm more confident that you take it than he takes it. I just think having a ton of people taking tough pull-ups when two guys are covering you, which means somebody's open on your team, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I don't think you need a lot of guys. So if you want to take his position, let's spend the next month waking up and spending an hour, 2 hours together at 6 a.m. every day, and you'll pass. Just understand, when you pass him, Oz is going to start getting up at 5 a.m. And I'm good with that too, because I don't care who it is, and I don't care if both of you get unbelievably great at it, because when he graduates, you're going to be great at it. But it's always a competition. And they're welcome to question me on it. But I think when people say, well, you limit people when you put them in these spots. No, I think you limit people when because those things are going to play out. If someone stinks, their teammates are going to stop them from taking that shot. I want them to want to be in that spot. So getting back to the technical side of it, so we know who, like a certain two perimeter guys, we know they're looking to penetrate every chance they get. And the only time they're not going to look to penetrate is if they've got the post in a one-on-one matchup and it's a post matchup in a place where that's a better matchup. So we know who's going to penetrate. We know who we're going to play through the post with and what side of the floor, middle of the floor, and what side of the floor we're going to play through the post. And we know when we pass it to a certain wing that he's likely not going to penetrate unless he's got a layup. So we can go high-low and play out of that. So in our transition, we always know what we're doing. And when a guy says, well, I always get put in the non-matchup spot, I go, well, here's the deal. Get better. And here's the deal. As soon as the guy in the matchup spot screws up twice, get him out of that matchup spot and you go there. Because you can't do any worse than he's doing. So there's your chance. Take a spot. And I'll back you up, because if he ain't getting a done down in that spot, he doesn't get to stay in that spot. And everybody says, well, it's too much pressure. You're putting people in tough situations. We're still trying to win. And if they can't handle the fact that they've got to earn it, they're not going to be ready for life. Now, how we say it to the university guys and how we say it to the grade fours is very different, but it's still the same. Like, I mean, I say to my grade one, hey, Gabe, if I was Rob, I'd put so-and-so, Nico, in the matchup spot, and I'd put you in the shooter spot. And he'll say, no, I'm better than Nico. I go, I'd put him in that spot. I mean, if you want to go to the gym and work on your game, maybe after an hour and a half of us working on your game, I might change my opinion. But right now, that's my opinion. And that's like, Dad, let's go to the gym. All right. So, you know, I get him in the gym. And because he wants to be better than so-and-so. I think competition is extremely important, and it's important within your team too.
Well, and again, you talked about that a lot in the first podcast, and I'm glad, again, it circles back to understanding, because I think that's what struck a lot of people from watching your practices, the all-access practices that you graciously allowed us to film, but that a lot of people were going to, I think going into it thinking it was going to be overly technical and tactical, whereas most of it was really, again, psychology. It was getting players to understand how to be better and putting them in positions where, you know, they have to fight for their learning, they have to fight for their development, all those different things. So I think you're hearing a lot about that in terms of that. So when you're working on spacing for 25 minutes, how are you doing that? Is that 5-on-5, 5-on-0? What are we doing in terms of that?
Well, I mean, first of all, I have one of my assistants just worried about spacing. So in anything we're doing, he is locked in on our spacing being right. And they change it up day to day, but one of them is always just watching spacing. I would say half of our shooting drills are rep shooting drills and half of them are spacing shooting drills. So, you know, I mean, people do shooting out of their action. We don't really care about our actions. We care about shooting out of our penetration and out of our spacing. So I would say half of our shooting drills are all based on spacing. So, I mean, I would say 95% of our practices were focused on spacing, but 25 minutes of it is locked in on how we're spacing on every penetration, on every post entry, on every offensive situation.
Yeah, well, it's great. And you can see the things that you focus on as a program, and they shine through in terms of how your team plays, you know, rebounding, transition, spacing, and then obviously the defensive focus that we've talked about already in terms of that. So you can see, I mean, the work pays off. So with that, then, I think you've answered this question based on what you said in terms of your example of Stu Turnbull and Oswaldo Giunti, but shot selection is something that a player is in control of through their development. But once you're obviously playing games, I mean, the best players are the ones you want shooting and the best matchups are the ones you want attacking. Is there anything else you talk about in terms of shot selection?
Well, I mean, our big thing is, and we talk about this daily, is we want to always have more offensive rebounds than the other team we're playing, and we want to shoot a higher percentage than the other team we're playing. So when you're trying to do those two things, it's not easy. If you are making more shots than the other team and you are getting more offensive rebounds than the other team, you're trying to get more offensive rebounds off less opportunities. You know, like people talk about like basically assists to field goals. See, I don't like that stat so much. I like it if you take into account how many offensive rebounds you get. I mean, we've had games where we've had 17 offensive rebounds. We don't get a lot of assists off those offensive rebounds because those turn into putbacks hopefully half the time. And the other half, it's a kick out to a three, so sure, we get some assist off of it. But it's a little deceiving. We want to get a ton of offensive rebounds, and we don't want to miss any shots. Well, if you don't miss any shots, how do you get offensive rebounds? Well, you have to be in a position to get every single offensive rebound. And the only way you're doing that is if you're taking shots that everybody on your team expects to be taken. And if you're taking shots when people don't expect you to take them, you cannot get an offensive rebound. So, you know, again, we do dictate in terms of three-point shots, who's going to be taking three-point shots and in what circumstance. You know, so there's certain guys on our team, if they're open, the ball doesn't have to get to 8 feet. You know, it doesn't have to get in the paint before they shoot a three. There's certain guys on our team, they're not allowed to shoot a three unless the ball's gotten to the paint. And there's certain guys on our team, they should never be in a position to shoot a three because they should be diving because they're not good enough shooters. So they should never touch the ball in that situation. And if they do, it's only because we're trying to get into some dribble handoff action or something like that. So, I mean, everybody knows when people are going to shoot the ball. We have rules on pull-up jump shots. I mean, we train one-on-one pull-up jump shots all the time because it's you've got to have a guy on the floor, maybe two, but definitely one, who is capable of making consistently 70% of their pull-up jump shots, because you're going to get late game situations where that guy needs to take, or late shot clock situations where that guy needs to take it, or he has to be such a threat to take it that they have to run at him and it gets us a wide open three. So we don't want many guys taking pull-up jump shots. To me, there's no reason why you're taking a pull-up jump shot unless it's late in the shot clock. If you're shooting it early in the shot clock, it's because they've run someone at you and you're not a good enough passer to get the ball to the person who's open, or you made such a bad move that one guy is able to force you into a pull-up jump shot. And if that's the case, it's going to be really hard for us to offensive rebound that miss because no one has to help and there's no offensive rebounding lane. So as much as we train it one-on-one, we really don't want to see it unless it's late shot clock. And I mean, again, so our shot selection is dictated on who is good at what, and you earn it. And you, I mean, our shooting chart, we talked a little bit about it before. So in our practices, if, I mean, it changes day to day, but you know, the ideal day when I'm in a good mood and everything's sort of going where it needs to be, if we have 15 guys on the shooting chart, the top three guys in the shooting chart, they're allowed to shoot threes before the ball gets to 8 feet. If they're open, they get to shoot threes anytime they want. And if they make a three, they get the points for that three plus three more. So if we're counting twos and threes, if I'm 1-3 in the shooting chart and I make a three, I get 6 points for that three. What that does is it makes people want to be in the top three in the shooting chart. So they shoot a ton and they challenge each other a ton so that they can get to that top three in the shooting chart. What it also does is it makes the defense be very aware of who gets 6 points for every three they make. And if they allow that guy to make a couple of threes, they're losing that drill. So it really dictates our defense in not letting shooters get shots. And I think it has led us to be a really, really good team defensively in defending the three-point line. Because we kind of, as funny as it sounds, if a guy can't shoot, we don't cover him. Yet we still keep teams to a really low percentage from the three. And some of them, we let them shoot. They just can't shoot. So they're going to shoot a low percentage. Some of them can really shoot. And we, day to day, are aware that that guy's worth 6 points in our practice. So the three he makes in a game is nothing. So 4 to 6, they now cannot shoot anytime. The ball has to get to 8 feet before they can shoot a three in any kind of practice situation. So the ball needs to be penetrated before they shoot it. Everybody knows that, but anytime they make a three, it's worth 3 plus 2. So they get 5 for every three they make. So we still play them as shooters as defensively, but the ball's got to get to 8 feet before they can shoot it. And then 7 and 9, it's the same. Ball's got to get to 8 feet, and they get 1 plus 3. 10 to 12, they shouldn't be shooting many threes. It's got to get to 8 feet, and they only get the three. They don't get an addition. But most of those guys are divers. And anybody above 12, if they make a three in practice, it doesn't count for anything. It's zero, because it's just, even a blind squirrel finds an acorn once in a while. They just got lucky.
What a great way to connect the shoot. And I've got questions already about the shooting chart, but what a great way to connect it to actually what happens in the game. And then that's the value of that, is that it clearly defines for your players and helps them understand, you know, their strength and the strength of the team. And also they're not limited, right? They can work their way up and down the chart depending on how much work they put in.
Yeah. Sometimes, Chris, I forget to look at the chart before mm-hmm. I go into practice, and somebody who was 5 2 days earlier is 3, and he's coming down in transition and jacking. And I'm going, like, before I get mad at him, I go into our team room and check the board. And I go, he's 3. What am I going to say?
That's great. Well, I'm sure he would remind you too. So that's awesome. Dave, this has been enlightening.
And between these two podcasts, thank you so much for taking the time and providing information to coaches that I think is invaluable. And personally, again, I'm biased, but I don't know why as a coach you would listen to this and not have got your all access videos at davesmartbasketball.com, because it's actually, you know, would tie the two things together, what you've heard and what you see. And those videos are raw, and I appreciate you providing access to be able to do that. But anything else you'd like to share with people in terms of your concepts and philosophy and then your coaching?
No, I mean, we can think about it, and maybe we can do a third one. I mean, I really enjoy this, and I appreciate you having me on. I could talk just like you, and I could talk basketball for hours and hours and hours, or sports on it for hours. So I enjoy this stuff. I mean, we've worked together, so you know that how I operate. I mean, it's a learning thing. I mean, it's the defense. I was talking to our women's coach now, about where the defense is compared to where it was when he left to coach women 12 years ago. And it's almost a fully new concept. I mean, you just in terms of all the things we've felt we had to add and things that we've moved around. And I think that's the big thing with coaches is, you know, they pick things up, but they've got to be comfortable with what they do. And they also have to do it within their own personality. But things have to change. I mean, things evolve. I mean, in our world, the 24-second shot clock, the 14 after an offensive board, like, the game is always evolving. The game's gotten smaller, but you have to evolve without losing sight of the old school stuff. You know, I tell this story all the time that, you know, and you would relate to this because you do so many camps with young kids and some kids who have never played basketball. But, you know, I was at one of our camps a number of years ago, and there's this little 7-year-old kid, and he was such a keen kid and such a cute kid and so much fun to talk to. And at the end of the week, I said, "So what was your best part of the camp?" And he goes, "Oh, just working with all the guys from Carlton. It was so neat. They were so nice." And I go, What'd you learn? And he said, "Oh, I learned this." And then I go, "Do you have anything else you want to ask?" And he goes, "Coach, that zigzag full court drill that you do every day with your team," he goes, "like, we did it every day. So it was so cool because you said you do it every single day with your team. And I thought it was so awesome that we get to do it. I'm going to go home and do it. I'm going to get my dad to watch me do it. And I think it's neat that Phil does it every single day." And I walked away and I turned to one of my assistants and I go, "We don't ever do that drill anymore." And he goes, "Yeah." And he goes, "Yeah, I mean, it's zigzag." And I go, yeah, we need to start doing that drill every single day again, because we can't cover the ball in the full court. We've been sitting there watching film, going over with guys what they're doing wrong. That's why we can't cover the ball the way we used to cover the ball in the full court. We don't do that every day. From now on, we are doing that every day. And once we get good at it, we'll do it twice a week. And it, like, for me, that day from that little seven-year-old who was just talking, I look at things and I go, we don't play one-on-one enough. We don't play, you used to joke about our three-on-three, cross-screen, down-screen, like all the three-on-three crap. Like, we don't do that stuff as much as we used to do it. And we're not as good as we used to be at that skill. Like, not getting too far ahead of yourself. Again, and listening to when people talk to you. I mean, I go ask these questions to the 6, 7, 8-year-olds at our camp all the time, because they're so innocent. They just say stuff. And 90% of it is just funny and cute and like it's fun to talk to them. But 10% of it I actually use, like, just because I've gotten away from it. I've thought I was way too smart and gotten away from stuff that we need to do.
What a great example of learning from anyone. And for me, reflecting on camps, I mean, I wouldn't be the type of coach I was if I didn't every day in some way through camps have to put my concepts, put my teaching in front of kids, and then seeing what feedback I get from them, either verbal, like you just said there, or in terms of how they execute it, because they teach us what we teach well if we pay attention and what we don't teach well. So really good example there as well. So I think people are going to take us up on the offer of doing a third one at some point, and we'll give it some time. But Dave, again, thanks so much. And everyone go to davesmartbasketball.com and get coaches all access practices. And we look forward to seeing somewhere where you end up in your next steps as well, coach.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Basketball Immersion is one-stop shopping for video learning to stimulate your basketball coaching using evidence-based practices. Watch hundreds of videos covering BDT shooting, zero-second skill training, how we teach using small-sided games and a games approach to coaching, as well as team concepts and systems like trail trap, flow offense, two-sided fast break, and much, much more. NCAA, NBA, pro, high school, and youth coaches are amongst the thousands of coaches who are a part of our community. Go to basketballimmersion.com today to stimulate your basketball coaching.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.